Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I am a health, food, and environmental journalist covering these topics on this radio program and on my posts on the Huffington Post, Alternet, EcoWatch, and my website, healthjournalist.com. You can also find me on Facebook. I've been covering everything that affects our health for the last 25 years, connecting the dots between our personal health and everything going on in our world, our inner state, our well-being, the health of our families, communities, and society all depend upon seeing health in context with all of life and with the state of the earth. And I report every week on different facets of this and have these wonderful conversations that are now going on for 4 years with some terrific guests, authors, experts, advocates, thought leaders of various kinds. And today, a returning guest, who's a real joy, is a author, humorist, and comic with a cosmic perspective. And we've had him on the show before. We'll talk a little bit about that. And so, you know, sometimes our topics are fairly intense here because of what's going on in our world, which we report on. But today we're going to get some comic relief with author, humorist, and workshop leader Steve Behrman, also known on the comic circuit as Swami Bayandananda, the cosmic comic. His comedy has been described both as comedy disguised as wisdom and wisdom disguised as comedy. So be prepared for the healing power of laughter on today's show. Author Marion Williamson has called Steve the Mark Twain of our generation. He writes a political blog with a spiritual perspective, Notes from the Trail. And we featured him before in Connect the Dots and had a wonderful rollicking time when his recent book, Spontaneous Evolution, was published. And it's still a real gem. So welcome back to Connect the Dots, Swamiji Steve.
Well, thank you. By the magic of radio, I can be a multiple personality. I can change costumes at the blink of an eye. So if you blink an eye, you might become the Swami, just like that. Okay, so you got two of us here talking.
Okay. Oh, I see. We've got you and the Swami. Oh, that's great.
This is two for oneness day. For oneness Wednesday. So you got them both.
Oh, that's just excellent. Oh, that's just excellent. Well, welcome, Steve, and welcome, Swamiji. So, you know, especially with, let's just jump right in. You know, we just done a month on techno-utopia, the fantasies that, you know, technological fixes are going to save all the things that we kind of stirred up and troubled in our world. And, you know, the delusion of that and why it's not working with a series of guests that were present at a wonderful teach-in in New York that I was featuring, and we've had some great guests for over a month. And in that time, you know, the very next kind of thing that came along was the election. And I don't think, I think this is something a lot of people are kind of gnashing their teeth about and crying about, and I certainly would be one of them. But, you know, I guess there's, I mean, humor is a long, you know, a well-honored coping device and mechanism for survival, especially in the ethnic background from which both you, Steve, and I come. I can't speak for Swamiji. So, you know, what can laughter as a tool do for us?
Well, first of all, you did acknowledge that I have a black belt and borscht belt. So that's in that tradition. What I've been learning, my website, of course, is Wake Up Laughing, and that really, to me, says it all about what I've learned. That laughter is not just, and comedy, not just a tool for coping, mm-hmm. but a tool for transformation mm-hmm. And education. Mm-hmm. Why do most people, or many, many, many more people, get their their news and political education from The Daily Show or The Colbert Report or Bill Maher? It's because it's one of the ways we can tell the truth by simply exposing the blatant contradictions that pass for normal. what passes for sane. I mean, both this insanity of only the material world is real, we can talk more about that you described in this techno-fix utopia or dystopia, because it will be a place without humanity and without heart. And it's not really possible to operate outside the web of life like that. And then in terms of the election, what can you say other than just because the Republicans are snidely whiplash doesn't make the Democrats Dudley Do-Right? You cannot basically say we're not as bad as the other guys and expect to engender any genuine heartfelt support. We have a political party, the Democrats, who are suffer from lack of leadership, vision, and courage. But other than that, they're holding a place for us. So part of what's going on right now is that, these have been called apocalyptic times. And when you go back to the original meaning of the word apocalypse, it meant the lifting of the veils. And so the veils are being lifted simultaneously on the various toxic kinds of things in our political system, these perpetrations that have been taking place and are taking place right now. Simultaneously, the veils are being lifted on many of these spiritual tools that have been kept in protective custody. For example, we have the Chinese medicine and Vedic medicine. We have shamanistic practices. We have native practices from all across the world that are being released because these are some of the tools that we need. And so in all of this times of great change, great crisis and opportunity, humor is a hugely valuable tool because it breaks us out of the this or that mind. You're either with us or against us. It's either this or that, Democrat or Republican. And you ever wonder why jokes are all threes? A minister, a priest, and a rabbi. Okay. Mm-hmm. So why a minister, a priest, and a rabbi are discussing their legacy? How do they want to be remembered? What do they want people to be saying at their eulogy? And the minister thinks, he says, well, I want people to say he was a family man and a pillar of his community. The priest said, well, I want people to say he was a holy man and a leader of his flock. And the rabbi says, I want people to say, look, I think he's breathing. So basically, the purpose of humor in times like this that require transformation is to bust us out of the trends of the mind that it's got to be this or that, create the space for enlightening to strike, and have a new liberating thought that leads down a different pathway.
So, in fact, we kind of, even, when we try to sort of seek out spiritual solutions, we kind of get entranced by those, and there's no space or opening. There's just kind of, it's really interesting because one of the things that I've been at work on a book that kind of connects the dots in all the ways that we do on this radio program, so that people really understand the web of creation and the web of devolution that we've imposed upon creation, so that we can kind of unwind some of that. That's really the purpose of the book. But one of the things, and I hardly ever talk about it on the radio program here, but one of the things that I'm often, kind of instructed is, well, we need the solutions. Where are the solutions? And so we also become very driven and focused on offering solutions. This is a solution. That's a solution. Meditate every day, and that can be a solution. All of these different things are tools and solutions. I mean, what happened for me when you just made that joke is that it just emptied the mind of almost anything that was going on, so that instead of, kind of fixating on a solution, you could be open to seeing something in a new way.
Exactly.
Your comments?
One of the great projects I've worked on was this book called Spontaneous Evolution with Bruce Lipton, cellular biologist. We could talk more about that. But one of the quotes in the book, and it's almost become a cliched quote, which means we have to explode it even further, But it's the Einstein quote, the problem cannot be solved at the level of the problem. Mm-hmm. If we look at most of the solutions, I mean, look at the Democratic Party. Every one of their solutions is designed to address a problem specifically created by the context that we're living out of. So most things that happen are about content, not context. Change mm-hmm. the content. If you really want to change the content, change the context. And so maybe instead of solutions, we need better questions. We're not asking the right questions. Mm-hmm. I've got it in my work that I'm my a book that I'm working on right now. We have something called frequently unasked questions, FUQ. And mm-hmm. these frequently unasked questions are the ones mm-hmm. that not necessarily will lead us to answers, but will lead us to more refined questions that actually, as you say, connect the dots and roll things out differently. So,
what would be an example of some of those?
Well, for example, how about a question about economics? Here's a question. Does it make sense for us to run our economic system like a casino, where very, very, very few people win big and most people lose? That's a question that pulls us out of the current context rather than how do we fix the economic system, patch up a few things so it looks like it's more just than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than questioning, is that really how economics takes place inside of this emerging reality? And, you know, you're connecting the dots. And in spontaneous evolution, my colleague Bruce Lipton suggests two things about human evolution and evolution of our society. First of all, if we look at the patterns of evolution, we see that the next phase of human evolution is recognizing that we're part of a larger system, that we're cells in the body called humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's the case, then let's look at how we relate to one another, and let's look at the structures we've set up based on this understanding and what people end up doing every day. How many people go out to work every day and are doing something that adds to the greater goodness, that actually creates and expands more love and functionality and truth and beauty on the planet? Mm-hmm. How many people do that? People who listen to your show, probably more of those people are involved in endeavors that really express the love that's inside of them and try to connect that love with something that is required in the world out there. So mm-hmm. we end up living out of the context, out of the field that's been established generally without questioning that field. You know,
mm-hmm.
and so, you know, we have, you know, why is it that it's a kid who says, hey, aren't those the emperor's buttocks that I'm seeing over there? And the emperor's buttocks are everywhere, except that we've been trained to not see. I call it Nazism. We've been trained to not see what's in front of us because it's too threatening to see that. It would be too disruptive to the reality of the people around us, and
uh-huh.
we might lose our job.
Yeah, so actually fear of losing our job, our place, or whatever, kind of has a stranglehold to a certain extent on people. And therefore, you know, that fear kind of clutches down, creates a kind of mental trance, you know, very understandable and everything. But as a result, we're not seeing, as you point out. So once you kind of shake that up or mess that up, you have to kind of keep going with it, it would seem like, because, you know, if you just do it today, it could pose some dilemmas for people. I can imagine it posing certain dilemmas.
Right. You know what Swami says? When you are faced with a dilemma, make the lemonade.
And what is the lemonade?
Well, the lemonade, it's interesting. The journey that my wife Trudy and I have been going through for the last 3 years, we've jokingly and seriously called involuntary simplicity.
Involuntary simplicity?
Yeah. We had a chance for voluntary simplicity. That was 20, 30 years ago when Wayne Elgin wrote that wonderful book. But what's happened is that evolution, which is really crisis, demanding change and shaking things up, evolution is having its way with us, like it or not. It's the direction that things are moving. So what happens during these evolutionary times is that the structures in our lives that no longer serve are being disrupted and collapsed. For some people, the structures are relationships that have been long-term relationships that have had a hollowness or inauthenticity, and they've dissolved. Or people have required changes in order to move on with their true lives. Some people, it's been economic. People have lost their jobs. They've been downsized. They thought they had money saved from Bernie Madoff, made off with their money. All of these things. Some people have health challenges where there is a signal coming from their body saying that there is something fundamentally that needs to change in their lives. So what we've been seeing in our travels and doing our programs is that many, many, many people have experienced these disruptions in structure. And in the collapse structure, what happens is that somebody who loses their job finds their dream. They realize that that there is this little voice that's been nudging them along to do something that is a bit that's outside the box, that is daring. You know, it's like that wonderful Billy Joel song from 30-something years ago, My Life. You know, it's now he's doing the stand-up routine in L.A. Somebody looks at ordinary life as it's been laid out for them, particularly people who are younger, and they go, I'm not on that path. I don't want to spend 40 years going to work wishing the time passes quickly. So the good news and the bad news and the disruption and loss is that there's an opportunity to redesign one's life path based on something that's more authentic, because the inauthentic facade has blown away. Not to say that that's not painful. You know, and I remember back in the 70s when there were all of these very, you know, disruptive Fritz Perls type encounter groups and stuff that really, in a way, blew people's lives away without really offering anything and left people standing in the rubble of a destroyed relationship or something like that. And it's like, well, you know, tough. Figure it out. And I'm not saying that we need to do that. However, I think that we need to look at the structures in our lives and ask ourselves a simple generative question. Is this my love now? Is this the way that I am to be expressing my love in the world? And when you begin to focus much more on the bigger picture of your connection with life, and rather than on the smaller things of, you know, the day-to-day, how am I going to make a living and all of those things, because that's really on the field of the problem rather than on the bigger change of context. So we need to switch from the context, as Swami would say, of emergency to emerge and see.
And so part of your work, when you tour, when you do your comedy programs, is you see that I agree with you that it is widespread. I think it's very widespread. Although, you know, actually I was invited to work on a book project, and you know, one of the things that the book was about, you know, someone from our generation or time looking back on a lifetime of friendships and looking at how friendships changed over the life cycle. But of course, that's going to be different transformation depending on the path that anyone has been on. And, you know, this was kind of harkening back to the book, Gail Sheehy's book, Passages. And I went and took a look at that book, and there was, these assumptions that, that were kind of ironclad and sort of, she wrote about it in a sort of peppy style, but the underlying assumption was, oh, here's what you do in your 20s, and you either do this or that. Here's what you do in your 30s after you've done that in your 20s, and all these tracks were laid down. And I looked at that, and I said, gee, you know, most of the people of my generation aren't on that particular track necessarily. And certainly many of the millennials in the 20s and 30s are not on the same track at all. I mean, you know, everything has kind of really been thrown very wide open. And I discussed this with several friends. And, you know, what was interesting was that some people were like, oh, no, there are people still just getting married in their 20s, having kids right away, you know, doing all the things that, you know, were part of the traditional American good life. And I began to think, well, is it just simply the people I know? Because everybody, you know, most of the people I know are in the kinds of work, relationship, economic, you know, and other kinds of transitions you're describing, you know, and then to someone else, no, it's all the same old as it's ever been kind of thing. So, that was kind of, you know, a bit astonishing to me. But, you know, what is it, Steve? Is it the people we know, or is it, you know, is it that widespread? Are the people we know kind of the first responders to a social shift? What's your feeling?
Well, you know, the first thing that really exploded me out of the ordinary, I spent my deformative years in Brooklyn, you know, so I... and when I went...
Oh, God.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it had its ups and its downs, you know, but anyway, and now, of course, Brooklyn is the destination, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. it's a place to live.
I'm speaking to you from Brooklyn, at, you know, right now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, no kidding. Well, I used to, yep. I lived in a housing project, and yeah, that's where I learned comedy, by the way. When the older kids would ask me for money, I'd go, hey, look, I live here. If I had money, would I be living here? They'd laugh and leave me alone. So I was doing stand-up for money at the age of 8, you know, but it was my money. Okay, so mm-hmm. so anyway, I had a very interesting conversation with my brother yesterday, and he, you know, his career path was different than mine. He took the corporate route and so on. But in a mm-hmm. certain regard, we both chose, we chose to not have kids. We got married to people who, for what one reason or another, didn't have children. We were, and he was telling me about a family event that he went to, and so many people who now are in their early 60s and so on, who are retiring from teaching in public school, he said, frankly, these people were all very miserable throughout their careers, you know, and we looked at what we've been doing for the past 30 or 40 years and go, we haven't been miserable. We've mm-hmm. had bigger lives than most of the people who stayed in the hood or, you know, moved to Long Island.
That's the extension of the hood. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the next extension of the hood, you know, or mm-hmm. Florida, right?
Mm-hmm. We just the kind further of exploded extension out. Of the hood.
Yeah, exactly. It's the last place, you know, the last passage. In fact, we were just watching some wonderful Seinfeld reruns that had the whole, you know, appearance in Florida in the 1990s kind of thing. That was just hilarious. But anyway, we took slightly different paths and so on. So most of the people I know are people who did something different. And those are the people I've chosen to spend my time around. And my brother and I talked about how these are times where you lose track of most of the people who are in your family, if you're not in the geographical location where everybody is. Mm-hmm. And then you begin to cultivate, as we started doing when we were in our 20s and 30s, family, friends who are family, peers, mm-hmm. Et cetera, et cetera. And so the new family really is a family of peers. If I think about who do I want to get together with when I travel, mm-hmm. It's the people that I've met who are up to something. And that really, that's the biggest distinction I think I've made. You know, when I left New York and went to graduate school at Antioch, mm-hmm. I was at Antioch Putney Graduate School, Urban Teaching Corps. First night and second night, I didn't sleep. I stayed up all night because these people were interesting. They had, most of them were older than me. They had been in the Peace Corps. They had done this, and I'm going, what is it with these people? And it's mm-hmm. that they see life bigger than life inside that box where you do what's in the manual until your manual runs out of pages, and you go, oh, now what? And so we had, I think that most of the people that we know, and I think that this is good because it's what makes life interesting, are people mm-hmm. who have chosen the path less taken and have been trailblazers. And, you know, funny, Gail Sheehy was probably one of those people, but she wrote that book, what was it, 1978 or something like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. 76.
It was a great book. I love that book. I thought mm-hmm. that she was a very wise journalist and psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
And based on what we knew 35 years ago, it was very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But it's different today. It's a bit different today. Those who took the other path are increasing in number, and those who remained loyally on those paths are not being well supported by that decision, then you have a major social shift that's happening. And, you know, we sort of see the outer forms of it, but we're all living it. You know, we're all living it in different ways. So you're sort of celebrating the opportunity in that at the same time as, you know, in trying to affirm that, while at the same time we all need help in navigating that because it gets more challenging. I mean, I know that, I know my dad, who is a very kind of knuckle-down, do-the-right-thing in a very dutiful, traditional sense kind of person, you know, he always harped on retirement as being, you know, the most important thing in life to plan for because, you know, you would be in tremendous discomfort if you were, you know, sort of ice skating into your elder years, you know, without everything kind of the fort locked down. And, you know, the fort isn't locked down, you know, in my life or in our society. You know, your comments on that.
Well, first of all, looking at it from a big, big, big picture, and Bruce and I go into this more deeply in Spontaneous Evolution,
mm-hmm.
The idea of the individual, the celebration of the individual as a separate, discrete entity from
mm-hmm.
community, from the
mm-hmm.
matrix of anything. And so, you know, as we shifted from, you know, people said, what happened to the 60s? And this, my cynical side says
mm-hmm.
that, well, no, not my cynical side. I'm sorry, I don't really have a cynical side anymore. My willingness to look at reality side says the KKK was replaced by the KKK, which was Kill Kennedy, King Kennedy, and the Kent Kids. And
mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of the, I think we're still in post-traumatic stress disorder as a civilization, as a society,
yep.
from the Kennedy assassination,
mm-hmm.
from the heart being ripped out of us by us not being told the truth about it,
mm-hmm.
and by everybody politically dancing around all of this stuff when there's been a huge perpetration that has destroyed the fabric of our family and connections together as a society.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, until that, you know, huge elephant and donkey, because both political parties are involved in the living room, gets addressed, then we're going to be kind of skating around the edges and not being able to make the change. And that's why the Democratic Party is so ineffective, because they are not willing to face the dark shadow of America. They're pretending
mm-hmm.
that a couple of patches will fix it up. And in
yep.
our heart of hearts, we know that that's not the truth.
Right.
So, first of all, let's get into the context of this huge wound that whether we were alive in November of 1963, whether we were kids, adults, not born yet, it doesn't matter. We're all suffering from this reverberation of a perpetration that's really, we haven't been told the truth about. And so,
mm-hmm.
you radiate out from something like that. When you build a society on false premises and false foundations, this is what you have. If we go back to the founding of this country, as Bruce and I discuss in Spontaneous Evolution, much of our structure was based on the Iroquois Nation. They had the separation of powers. Benjamin Franklin was very influenced by looking at the structure of the Iroquois Nation. They had different branches of government. They had checks and balances. The one thing that they had that the founders of this country couldn't quite wrap themselves around was the Council of Grandmothers, that the elder women in the tribe were the ones who got to this, who decided whether a tribe went to war. They also could impeach an incompetent or unscrupulous chief and replace them. And I guess the idea of Betsy, Martha, you know, Dolly, kind of making the decisions like that, they couldn't do it. And so what that means is that we are now 230-something years outside of the connection to the sacred feminine, to the web of life, to the part of us that has respect for the natural world. And we've spun into, you know, the Cartesian notion that only the material world was real. Everything is a machine. And, you know, when you hear a pig squeal when you're killing them, oh, that's like the squeaking of a wheel of a machine. And so without that aspect of the feminine, and I'm not talking about Hillary here, without that aspect of the feminine, we are bereft. We're operating on one cylinder. We're out of touch. We're out of connection. And that, at the same time, with the focus on only the individual developing their life outside of the context of all of these other things, it's like, you know, it's like Swami's joke, you know, if we lose the web of life, there goes the GDP, you know. So.
Oh, God. You know, on that note, we will take our session identification break. That's absolutely hilarious, and I hope that our listeners are also experiencing the healing power of looking at these things with a sharp, clear eye, as you're doing, and also being able to laugh at the absurdity of it in a way. You know, there's something nourishing about that to the spirit in us that has to, you know, live in this world you know, keep on coming and you know, be warriors for the life force. So stay with us, listeners. We'll be talking more with our two guests today, comic, humorist, author Steve Behrman and his sidekick, Swami Beyondananda, after the break. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm talking with Steve Behrman, a.k.a. Swami Beyondananda, and we're talking about Wake Up Laughing, the role of comedy in thriving and awakening to facing up to healing and dealing with our world. you know, I just want to give a shout-out to his website, www.wakeuplaughing.com. You'll get his calendar there, his writings, links to his incredible book, which Spontaneous Evolution, which we featured on the show when it came out a couple of years back, and we probably have an old radio show in archive. In fact, we do at the Connect the Dot Archives that will be joined by this show, and you can also check that out. If you're just tuning back in, please do check out our archives. This show will be up, the full-length show will be up in the Connect the Dot Archives on the Progressive Radio Network later this afternoon. If you like the show, please like us on iTunes, pass this along to your friends. And do check out Steve and Swami's website. Maybe you want to reintroduce Swami to our second half listeners so that they kind of get a sense of what we're talking about here, Steve.
Oh, yeah. You know, you called Swami my sidekick, and he's been kicking me on the side the whole time going, I want to talk. So I am here. I am here with Swami, and one of the things I do is I answer your questions, and you will question my answer. So if you have an answerable question, I have a questionable answer for you. So ask me something.
Okay, I have a question for you, Swamiji. You know, what can people do to address the tremendous concern that we're destroying the habitability of the planet for ourselves and other species via global warming? What can we do?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that the Earth is always going to be here until the sun goes away. So, first of all, we got to know that we cannot destroy the Earth. The Earth can destroy us, however. And so we have to understand that there is a natural balance to everything. Okay, so let's say that, yes, it is true. Over the past several generations, the planet has gotten warmer. Yes, but over the past several generations, each generation of kids are actually cooler than their parents.
Well,
Now, listen, people ask me all the time, Swami, is climate change real? Is it real? You know, I travel in the future all the time. I just got back from a fabulous one-week vacation in Tropicana. Okay, so that should answer your question.
Well, this brings up another question, and I'm sure you've thought about this one. If the current generation of kids is cooler than, you know, the previous generations, what can those cool kids best do to get a handle on the problems that we, you know, smart adults have created in our world and left to them?
Well, first of all, there's more good news. You know, in the old days when something like this happened and people said, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, there would be a revolutionary uprising to overthrow the system. Well, now in these times, we realize that we have to shift from emergency to emerge and see a new context. And so what we have now is an evolutionary uprising to overgrow the current system. And we have a simple four-step program, which works actually three times faster than 12-step. And the four steps are wake up, wise up, grow up, show up. Wake up to the joke that we have been using our energy to fight one another, and it's like autoimmune dysfunction. So when we wake up to the fact that we are all connected, that the universe has us surrounded, might as well surrender, okay? Then we realize that we are fighting a force that does not need to be fought. Yes? And then we wise up to the power of love. We leave the dueling dualities of the head for the unity of the heart. The static of the head for the ecstatic of the heart. Yes? Love. I'm telling you, love is more powerful than fear. We have to recognize that. Otherwise, we'd all be singing, All You Need Is Fear, right? She fears you, yeah. We're not singing that. Okay, so that's good stuff. Wake up, wise up. Then we have to grow up. We have to grow up from children of God to adults of God. You know, Jesus was an evolutionary. Did you know that? Jesus believed in evolution. Otherwise, he would have said, now don't do a thing till I get back. Right? Okay, he didn't say that. So we have to become adults of good. Finally, we have to show up. We have to show up ready to play this new game of life that's different. Instead of every person for themselves, it's the game of we're all in this together. Instead of survival of the fittest, it's thrival of all. That's the new game. And people have to design for themselves, even though plans are meant to be changed. You have to design yourself. What is it you want to do in life, right? A lot of people, they have bucket lists. You know what a bucket list is, right?
Yeah.
It's a list of all of the undertakings you wish to undertake before being overtaken by the undertaker, right? So,
for a lot of people, it's a list of places they want to go. That's how I usually hear it listed. You know, where do I want to go? What place in the world haven't I seen? You know, that kind of thing. But you're talking about a different kind of bucket list.
Well, I think for some people, it's finding their place in the world and finding the things that they want to do that are related to other people. Because, again, you know, in this individual world, what is it that, you know, there have actually been studies of people who, when they're in their last days, if they're in hospice and so on, they're reviewing their lives. And what they most remember is what they love. And so much of our lives, if we live our lives based on the manual, which has not been updated in the last, I think, since in 500 years, or 5,000 years perhaps, because we've been living under the rule, either implicit or explicit, of the lowest common denominator for all of that time. And that's why we feel such a need to defend against everything and defend against... Right?
So, I love that. The lowest common
denominator. No, really. That's excellent. I mean, that's why the sociopathogens are so rampant in the body politic.
Oh, my God. That's really great. Yeah, that's really excellent. The social sociopathogens. Oh, that's excellent.
Oh,
Yeah.
Like, you know, I have nothing against criminals personally. I just don't want them running anything, you know. So.
That's excellent. 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 Well, you know, if there's this kind of like, if you can't beat them, you know, don't join them. I don't know. Like, you know, it's like, what do you have for that? Like, how?
Well, you know,
there's something empowering about what you're doing. Yeah, go ahead.
We just had this election, where essentially, you know, the Democratic Party reminds me of Lucy in the Peanuts cartoon, where, you know, every year it's football season and she insists that she's going to hold the football while Charlie Brown kicks it. And every year she pulls it away and he falls on his behind. And so the Democratic Party is a lot like that. You know, in 6 years ago, I was in Washington, D.C., about a week after the election in 2008. Mm-hmm. And the mood there was kind of felt like the fall of the Berlin Wall, or maybe that Jesus just came down in a spaceship. It really felt different. There was like ebullience. There was dancing on the streets almost. Mm-hmm. And well, now what happened? The hopium has worn off. And I think that what's happened is that because the Democratic Party is fundamentally unwilling to face the some of the darkness and recognize that the same forces that are now in power in the Republican Party, energetically, these are the same people who are the Watergate people. These are the same people who have been looking to steal back the economic power ever since the republic was established. How many people out there know that in 1933 there was a plot to overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt? There was a military plot. If you Google Smedley Butler, that was the name of the general, a Marine Corps general, who was going to be put in charge of this plot, which was essentially fomented by the DuPonts and so on to make sure that we didn't have a New Deal. Fortunately, Smedley Butler said no and exposed it, and the thing disappeared. He also wrote, he was by the 1930s, he had been the most decorated Marine general in this country. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a little pamphlet called War is a Racket. So if you Google War is a Racket, you'll find out something that's kind of a footnote in history. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that there was an actual plot to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt, who was willing to take on the banks. So we don't know history. And my background is history and political science, although I never actually got as far along in poli-sci to actually dissect a politician. I never got to that point, but in lab. My point is this, that people have been skirting around these kinds of issues, and what we really require in this country is a truth and reconciliation movement, like what happened in South Africa. Yep. Now, the fundamental reason why it worked in South Africa is because of a notion called Ubuntu, U-B-U-N-T-U. Yep. Mm-hmm. And for those who don't know what it is, it's this... it's really the same reverberation of functionality that's at the root of every spiritual or ethical system, some form of the golden rule, some form of saying that we're all connected, what you do to the least of us, you do to me, all of these things. And instead of the religions fighting one another like they've been doing, maybe in Alan Watts's words, it's time that we started noticing where the finger is pointing rather than worshiping the finger. So Ubuntu is a way of overgrowing this notion of religion and non-religion to get to a sense of the sacred that transcends our structures and also transcends language, that's bigger than religion and bigger than non-religion. And out of that bigger context, we will be able to create the truth and reconciliation and healing so that our leaders can actually be public servants, serve the will of the people, the bidding of the people, rather than the bidding of the highest bidder.
I really like that a lot. I actually, in other words, you know, we've talked, and I've spoken about and reported on and promoted as a health reporter for, you know, several decades, this whole thing of, you know, healing yourself, healing yourself, healing yourself. But how do you heal a society? And one of the things that you're pointing out is that just as a person has things that happened in their childhood that came from their family or traumas that occurred to them in their life of various kinds, you know, that are hurtful and that create suffering and ongoing patterns and degrade our outlook on life, ourselves, our health, whatever it is, in the same way, so do societies. And unless those things are addressed as a society, to keep, you know, monkeying around with these other kinds of fixes, A, we can't get to the fixes because these things function as blocks, but we don't, you know, we don't have a really great model or articulated pathway to do those social changes apart from, you know, some political action, which of course I'm 100% in favor of and promote all the time. And I think you're right that the healing potential is really in healing social movements, and that the truth and reconciliation is a great model. You know, the whole idea that we teach forgiveness, oh, forgive him, I forgive you, I'm doing it for my sake, that, you know, but we didn't acknowledge what happened. And so, you know, I don't know that functions very well in, you know, in an interpersonal relationship. Oh, just forgive him for his own sake or for my sake or whatever. You know, unless there's been some admission and acknowledgement, and certainly on a mass social level, it's not functioning well at all for us. How would you propose going about creating truth and reconciliation initiatives in this country? I think it would be tremendously helpful.
Well, first of all, I think we need a third wave political movement that acknowledges that a problem cannot be solved at the level of the problem. Tom Hartman calls it the radical center. And what I like about radical, what radical means is to the root. So you're going to the root of the situation, or as we call it, the situation. You're going to the root of it. And don't you love that word? It's a great word. You can say it on the radio, apparently. I just did. Well, anyway,
I know.
pardon me. So anyway, to get to the root of it, and the center is not the motherly center of, well, we'll kind of pave over our differences. No, it's to the fundamental issue of connection or separation. Mm-hmm. Are we in it together, or is it every man for himself? Mm-hmm. And I know you've been involved in the healing arts and so on. You're probably familiar with kinesiology, muscle testing. And
of course.
I think that if most political activists, well-meaning political activists, were tested on, I believe we can have a world of justice and peace, they would test weak. They would not test weak. Because
yes,
the field that exists, the field of beliefs, the invisible field of beliefs, is so pervasive that even if we externally espouse the ideas of connection, there's not the internal congruence. So first of all, we have to really, so this is where the individual comes in. Individually and in groups, because this is a fractal, it happens at every level of organization. It happens at the individual, the family, the community, the city, the state, the nation, the world, where we actually have to ask ourselves, what would we like instead? What do we stand for? What if every city had a mission statement? I'm serious about this.
Hmm.
Every country, a mission statement. The mission statement being, what is our contribution to the world? What is our contribution to the greater good? When people get up in the morning, they go, oh, I'm living out of this context of contribution.
Mm-hmm.
I'm living out of this context of what I do makes a difference. I may be hauling rocks, but I'm building a cathedral. And I'm not a slave to build a cathedral either. I'm thriving in that. I think that fundamentally the reason why we have not been able to govern ourselves is because we have until now not been able to trust ourselves to govern ourselves. And, you know, I urge you to read Spontaneous Evolution, not because I wrote it. Bruce Lipton and I we got together last week and we were joking about, we'll open the book and we'll go, wow, who wrote this? The book wrote itself through us. And in kind of the dots that we connect in this book, you know, we really are talking about how all of these things are connected, that you cannot disconnect politics, economics, psychology, the web of life. They're all part of the same conversation, and it boils down to one thing, connection or separation. Are we acting in the field of love, or are we acting in the field of fear? Field of fear. Fear is very important. Fear is an important signal that, oh, my God, if I stand in the middle of the road, that when that Mack truck reaches me, I'm going to get obliterated. Fear is very important signal to point out the actual dangers that face us. But if we're acting, you know, when a driver gives us the finger, which Swami calls half of a peace sign, when the driver gives us a finger, that is not the same as being chased by a saber-toothed tiger. When our boss is upset at us, that's not the same as a life or death condition. So recognizing that when we're put in fear or put ourselves in fear, we actually diminish our ability to think creatively. So part of this upwising, I'm working on three projects right now. Of course, continuing Wake Up Laughing as a way of promoting awakening and laughter simultaneously. I'm also working on a book called Healing the Body Politic, because I think that one of my assignments is as a healer of the body politic, and I'm doing this collectively. And thirdly is my project, Evolutionary Upwising, where we bring together the forces of those who see their work as a work of heart, as something that they love, that's being done to create good goods, greater goodness, weave a web of mass construction in the world. Very important that we know what we're living into. Otherwise, our energy gets pulled off into fighting against something, and that always will pull you back onto the field. One more thing. When I was a kid in New York, at the Brooklyn Children's Museum, one of the first computers was a tic-tac-toe game. The machine let you go first, but you could never beat the machine. Best you could do is tie, because the machine had it all figured out mathematically that if you go here, it goes there, and it matched your move, and you couldn't win. Well, the current game that the bad guys just won, it's a fixed game. So let's stop playing their game. Let's stop reacting and responding to their atrocities, and let's promote a positive vision that actually is about healing through truth and reconciliation, that is about living into a world that we're all in this together. It transcends political parties. It transcends you against me. And it's how can the 90% of us who aren't sociopaths agree on a system of governance, of rules of governance, rather than about the individual policies that reflect truth and justice, transparency, etc. You know, one of my favorite
We're coming up to the end of the hour here, but I can't think of a better note to end on than what you what you just said there, Steve, and I'm sure many of our listeners agree, and I also have the mission of helping to heal the body politic. So we're going to join forces, and, you know, I'm going to participate, join with whatever you're doing. I think it's very important. I love the way you've defined this conversation. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots.
And thank you for connecting the dots.
And thank you, Swamiji. And thank you, listeners.
Oh,